Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We've heard a lot of it lately. Talk of energy independence, reducing our reliance on foreign oil, moving away from dirty fuels. One possible way, one bridge, natural gas. It's much cleaner than coal, and by all accounts, the United States is swimming in it. But the big volume is trapped deep inside the earth in shale. Now we've got the technology to get it out, hydraulic fracturing, hydrofracking, and there's a fever to bring it. But what is the cost? This hour, On Point, America's enormous natural gas reserve and the rewards and cost of blasting it out. You can join the conversation. Are you holding out for wind and solar? Is it time to drill, baby, drill for shale gas? Do we know enough about the environmental cost, the risk to water? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear perspectives from right across the country today. Joining me first from Houston, Texas, is Ken Medlock. He's a fellow in energy studies at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. He's been consultant to El Paso Energy Corporation, where he analyzed North American gas and petroleum and power markets. Ken Medlock, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from the Natural Resources Defense Council, we're joined by Amy Maul. She's a senior policy analyst with the NRDC's land programs based in Colorado. With us today from Austin, Texas. Amy Maul, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Ken, first to you. Give us a sense of the scale and significance of natural gas trapped in shale. I know it's right around the world, but let's start with this country. In the United States, how much is down there? How significant a volume?
That's a great question. We certainly can say this. There's a lot. But, you know, we're still sort of learning as we drill, so to speak, and as we gather more information going down hole. So to give you, some perspective, we had an inkling of what we thought might be there in terms of what was technically accessible 5 years ago that was much smaller than what we think we can get to today. So we're still very much on the learning curve with this particular resource.
Technically accessible, that gets to technology. But just to give us some sense, I mean, there are people saying that the United States could be, if this were accessible and accessible safely, and that's a big question, but if it were, that we could be the Saudi Arabia of natural gas, that we may have recoverable natural gas supplies larger than Russia's famously gigantic resources. Does that make sense to you as a sort of broad description?
Well, I would say that's a little overblown. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is there is a lot of it. And quite frankly, we've known about shale formations for a long time. It's just been an issue of technology and what we could actually get to. So, yes, indeed, there are massive what we call gas-in-place estimates. But when you sort of think about the subset to which we can get to, which is where technology comes into play, it's a smaller number, but it's still very, very large, and it really does represent a sea change with regard to the natural gas market in North America.
Amy, we count on you to have a kind of a careful environmental eye on this to the NRDC. Does this look like an energy source that we should tap? Are the environmental costs worth the cost of going down, and we'll talk about how it's done, but going down and fracking it out of that shale?
Well, Tom, natural gas, it currently is an important part of our energy portfolio, and we think it needs to remain part of that portfolio as we go forward and we transition to a cleaner energy future. It has some benefits in terms of being cleaner burning than coal, but regardless of how much there is, and I think Ken outlined the potential uncertainty of how much there is, it's still a finite fossil fuel. And as a fossil fuel, it definitely brings environmental risks that we're extremely concerned about, and it is finite at some point in the next several decades, possibly. And so we really do need to focus on the cleaner energy options, energy efficiency, renewables, et cetera. We do think it's an important part of the portfolio as we go forward, but it's a shorter-term transition to what we hope will be a much cleaner long-term vision of our energy future.
So maybe a bridge, but a bridge that, by all descriptions I read, much cleaner than coal. Maybe how do the carbon emissions of burning natural gas compared to burning coal?
Well, burning natural gas is cleaner than burning coal, but there are a lot of other greenhouse gas aspects to natural gas production before you even get to the burning. So what the ultimate comparison is, what we call the life cycle analysis, really from getting it out of the ground to ultimately burning it and everything in between, we're not really sure about that yet. But burning it, it is substantially cleaner from a greenhouse gas aspect than burning coal.
But on balance, all things in, all considered, you're not sure it's cleaner than coal?
Well, in terms of really looking at the greenhouse, and when you say cleaner, if you're just talking about greenhouse gas aspects, if you look at the, you know, getting it out of the ground, transporting it, processing it, and burning it, we don't have the exact analysis yet. That hasn't been done.
So there's a lot to consider here. Ken, give us a sense for those who aren't in the biz and haven't been doing it for years. It's been going on, but as you say, the technology is advancing. How is this natural gas trapped in shale? Where is it? And hydraulic fracturing, what is it? How do people go about getting it out of the ground?
Well, it's excuse me, it's actually an actually marvelous sort of story, if you will, on the technology front. Now, environmental issues aside, of course, potential environmental issues, that is. But basically, we've known about shale deposits for a long, long time. There's just rafts and rafts of literature that has been put out by members of the American Association of Petroleum Geologists looking at, you know, what shale is and coming up with potential estimates for how much gas is in place. And traditionally, we think of shale as what we call a source rock. So it's where, sort of, if you will, all the hydrocarbons are cooked and then migrate up through more porous rock and are trapped ultimately into a conventional reservoir or basin that we would, you know, historically have thought of extracting natural gas from. Mm. But we moved into a situation in the late 90s, early 2000s, where we were really, you know, strapped for resources, if you will, from conventional plays. And we started to look in areas that, well, we knew there might be potential, but maybe they were marginal at best. Prices started to go up, and that's really what helped to trigger the expansion, if you will. So with the increase in price, it made some of those marginal prospects look better, and so there was some effort made to improve recoverability from some of these shale-type plays. And, you know, one of the real success stories on this front was the Barnett Shale, which is basically part of it sits under Fort Worth here in Texas. Mm-hmm. And there was some pioneering efforts done there where you actually would drill down into the shale formation and then drill horizontally and begin to frack the shale, which is in effect trying to crack something so that you can stimulate gas to flow that is no more permeable than your driveway. So
it's pretty solid, and you're going way, way down. This is, 6,000, 8,000 more feet?
It could be anywhere between 5,000 and 12,000 feet, depending on how deep the shale is and where it is in the country.
We're talking about miles and miles beneath the surface of the earth, and you go down in this fracking or fracturing. Hydraulic fracturing involves a kind of mixture of water and sand and chemicals, some of them toxic, that are blasted into that shale far, far beneath Earth to get the gas seeping out and recoverable, as you say.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the reason for the sand, water we need for the flow, obviously, but the sand is really meant to maintain the fissures that you create, if you will, when you actually frack the formation so that you can actually, you know, get increased permeability and stimulate flow for a long period of time. And it's not just sand that's used. Sometimes there are ceramic proppants, which is what they're typically called, that are used depending on, you know, how much penetration you need and what kind of flow rate you're trying to get. But that's typically why those kinds of materials are actually in the fracking fluid. Now with the, you know, things like hydrochloric acid and other types of chemicals, that's also meant to try to sort of increase permeability. That's the rub, right? Yeah. What's actually happening with these chemicals?
The chemicals go down Amy Mall and are pumped in a very targeted way at the shale to release the gas. Thing is, a lot of them come back up. They go down beneath the water table, so in some sense, maybe they're safe there. But on the way back up, it's much less controlled. The issue that we're reading about here is people concerned that the chemicals will end up in large portions of America's drinking water supply, with all of the potential ramifications of that. What are the risk factors there, Amy?
Well, we're very concerned about groundwater contamination potential from hydraulic fracturing. And there have been incidents around the country in several states where folks have had their groundwater contaminated shortly after a nearby hydraulic fracturing incident. Unfortunately, we don't feel like many of these incidents have really been investigated to the full extent so that we really know exactly what happened, why it happened, what's happened to the water, and how dangerous it is. And we feel that it's essential to have federal oversight for that reason. Right now, states are overseeing the hydraulic fracturing process. And gas production is happening in about 30 states. There is all this talk about this new shale play that's happening in the Northeast, as well as shale plays in a few other places in the country. But it's being produced in a lot of places, and these incidents, water contamination incidents, have been reported in Ohio, Arkansas, Pennsylvania, even one recently in New York, Colorado, Wyoming, Texas. So it's really become a national issue, which is one of the reasons why we think it's essential for federal oversight. We really need a lot more investigation to find out really exactly what's going on and how widespread it is.
Over the last 5 years, production from shale spreading out of Texas across Louisiana, Pennsylvania got a lot of attention when energy companies started buying up a lot of rights in the watershed that serves New York City, and people suddenly thinking, wait a minute, could we rob New York City of a safe water supply here, Amy? That's the kind of question mark you don't want to see hanging over a major energy source.
Well, exactly, and there are a lot of question marks, and we feel like that we need to answer a lot of those questions before much more of this drilling can go forward, especially in the New York City watershed, where the water supply is for millions and millions of people, and it would be incredibly, incredibly expensive, not to mention just complicated and difficult to really replace that water source.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the shale gas opportunity, maybe the shale gas dilemma, America's enormous natural gas reserve trapped in shale, and the rewards and cost, potential cost, of getting it out. Ken Medlock joins us from Rice University, a fellow in energy studies there, joins us from Houston, Texas. Amy Maul, Colorado-based, today in Austin, Texas, joins us from the Natural Resources Defense Council. She's a policy analyst there. Ken Medlock, explain for us, if you would. Amy's saying we need some federal oversight and regulation here, but there is what's been called the Halliburton loophole. This was brought in 2005 energy bill, inserted at the behest of Vice President Dick Cheney, former CEO of Halliburton, that says, what, we're not allowed to know what chemicals go into the hydraulic fracturing that brings up the shale gas? Is that right, Ken?
In a nutshell, yes. And it's quite frankly unfortunate, because I think what it's
done
is—
quite frankly incredible, isn't it?
Yes, it is. What it's done is it's invited a fight, if you will, for industry that didn't need to happen. In an era where we like to talk about enhancing transparency on all fronts, financial markets, energy markets, well, this is something that really goes against the grain. So at the end of the day, I think what energy companies need to do, and I've said this in multiple forums, is just get out in front of this. This is not a fight worth having, and it's not a fight they'll win, quite frankly.
What was the justification for concealing the chemicals used to hydrofrack, to bring up the shale gas?
Well, I think the primary justification that's been noted is one of competitive advantage. So an individual company doesn't want to give away its competitive secrets.
What's in their cocktail that they're blasting down there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they view this as a competitive secret because, quite frankly, if you've got two companies that are in a similar sort of acreage position, if one can, increase permeability through hydraulic fracturing because of its chemical cocktail better than the other, then they'll do better.
But these are often described as toxic chemicals, and some large portion do end up coming through the water table, do they not?
Well, I as Amy said, I think there's some studies that need to be done because I think that's an open issue at this point. There are reports of potential contamination, but then there's always the other side. Is it actually the hydraulic fracturing that's resulting in this contamination, or is it something else? And quite frankly, nobody really knows for sure yet. And that's my point. I think the industry, if they're going to really try to defend their practice, needs to get out in front of this and be very transparent about what it's doing.
Big opportunity, but a big sense of risk when the unknowns are sitting there around our water table. Let's bring our listeners in. Aurora, New York. David, you're on the air, David.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
There's also a timeline to this. New York State, we have a generic supplemental EIS, which is under review, and public comment is allowed to the end of this month, the end of December. The governor is the one person to withdraw this if he understands that it's as dangerous as it is. This thing does not protect us at all. This is a major issue in this area.
Now, this has come right up into New York, David. It's been a big issue in the Catskills and beyond, as this Marcellus shale is in your backyard there, or under your feet.
Yes. I'm not in the New York area. I'm in the Finger Lakes area where we have lots of water, and we have lots of water to contaminate, too.
So are you supportive because we need more energy? Are you worried because of the risk to water?
Oh, I'm blatantly worried, along with everyone else with any brains around this area. Unfortunately, there's some people, and this is an area in which some people are quite poor, have sold off in order to pollute their, taking the risk of polluting their farms and their properties in order to get a little money out of the gas company for the leases.
The energy companies are all over that area now, stretching from Pennsylvania up into New York, looking for leases that would let them drill. I mean, Amy Moll, do you see a solution on the way here nationally, federally? New York is looking at this itself. A comment period, as our caller David says, underway right now. But there's a lot of enthusiasm for this. Is it going to be derailed by real concerns over safety?
Well, there is legislation that's been introduced in Congress to close what you called the Halliburton loophole, and that would require the EPA to regulate hydraulic fracturing. We think that's really just a first step. It's a very important first step, and it's critical. But what that would do is set out a minimal floor. So, for as I said, right now states are regulating this practice, and some states may be doing a better job than others, but at least if the EPA was regulating at this minimal level, wherever you live, you would know that your state at least meets that minimal standard of safety because the federal government would have set that out. So that's really important. And we don't think that will hamper drilling or shut it down in any way, but we do think it will help protect people's drinking water. And I just want to say that's really only one of the issues that we care about when it comes to natural gas production. There are air pollution issues that we're very concerned about. There's toxic waste management issues that are unanswered. And hydraulic fracturing is a very important issue, and obviously groundwater contamination is just not acceptable. But there are a whole host of other issues also that we're working on.
Let's take a call from Clarksville, Tennessee. Jim, you're on the air. Jim.
Yeah, one of the questions that I do have, I mean, I'm not a rocket scientist, but the question I have is, what is the possibility of having more earthquakes?
It sounds kind of out there. On the other hand, Amy, there have been reports of earthquakes in some area where shale gas has been produced. Have there not at least some questions raised about a potential connection between shale gas drilling and hydrofracking and earthquakes? What about that, Amy?
Yes, there have been reports, and there have been some research papers done on human-caused earthquakes. And even hydraulic fracturing is a seismic operation that's setting off underground motion in a way. And so there's definitely research done. And I don't know how conclusive it is, but there is a lot of information on the web if people search there. And there have been reports, particularly in Texas lately, about small earthquakes cropping up where there is new drilling.
So we need energy, but now we're talking water, drinking water and earthquakes. It can start to sound intimidating. Kevin in Amherst, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for letting me join this sophist convention.
Sophist convention.
It's incredible. You've got people who are talking about things that they know absolutely nothing about.
Well, I have to take issue with you right there, Ken. I mean, Ken Medlock is down in Houston right in the middle of this whole business,
Ken,
and Amy Moll studied it for years.
Yeah, Ken, I understand.
And we've got callers with questions. We're interested to hear your perspective.
Let me address the, you know, you just brought up the earthquake question. let me address that. Lamont Doherty is a geologic lab connected with Columbia University. Susan Barnett, a reporter for WAMC, interviewed one of their geologists. When he said that earthquakes can be induced by injecting fluids underground, he was talking about micro earthquakes. This is a one or lower on the Richter scale.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be detected without instrumentation. It can't be felt. It isn't destructive. It's far underground. And, you know, nothing above a two is considered a micro earthquake.
Kevin, are you a geologist?
I am.
So you're saying, yes, indeed, it may shake things a little bit, but not to a degree that matters.
It doesn't shake anything, Tom.
Well, you just said it was a detectable earthquake.
It's detectable with instrumentation, but
right.
You can't hear it or feel it. It doesn't cause any damage.
Mm-hmm.
I've drilled in Pennsylvania and New York.
Mm-hmm.
I know the whole process, and the concerns about hydrofracking are blown wildly out of proportion.
Hey, we're wide open to learning here, but you know, when the water table safety comes into question, it seems reasonable to ask, do you feel certain that toxic chemicals coming up from beneath those water tables would not, will not, have not ever presented a risk?
When you drill a gas well, Tom, or an oil well, they're mostly gas wells in this area, the drill rig will drill down through the water table and set what is called a surface casing. It's a 13-inch pipe that is cemented in place, and the cementing of the surface casing seals off the water table. That's why the casing is there.
On the way down, what about the portion that comes back up?
It comes back up through the production casing, which is inside the surface casing.
Kevin, I want to go to Ken Medlock on just that point. Ken, is it that clear that you're going to recapture everything that's pumped out into the shale so far below ground and bring it up as our caller describes?
My understanding of the process is yes, it is. But, and this is my point, if it's such a clear-cut issue, and I actually do think it is, why stonewall questions? Why not get out in front, and why not actually engage in a little bit of public information, sharing of this stuff sort of publicly? It's a scary thing when, quite frankly, if somebody tells you that your water table might be in danger because of some new drilling activity, it's going to scare you. So I think it actually there's a little bit of onus that falls on the industry to sort of get out in front of this thing and be very transparent about what's going on and sort of educate the public, because most people have no idea what actually happens when a natural gas well is drilled and a field is developed.
People are clearly paying a lot of attention. Our caller Kevin may not think much of their questions, but as you say, when it's drinking water, it's very easy to understand why the concern is real. I want to go right now to Ramsey Adams in Youngsville, New York, executive director of the Catskill Mountain Keeper. It's an environmental group there dedicated to protecting the Catskills in upstate New York. Ramsey Adams, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
There's a lot of interest in shale gas in your region and in getting into hydraulic fracturing and bringing it up. You all have been quite fierce in opposition. Why?
Well, when we first found out that there was the new technology, hydrofracking, and that there was the Marcellus Shale underneath a huge swath of New York and a lot of the Catskills, we started to ask the tough questions. Most obviously, New York City's drinking water, which is, as some of your listeners may know, an unfiltered, pure source of water for 9 million New Yorkers. There are reservoirs that are enormous. And what you've got is the threat, not only just from contamination, from benzene and diesel fuel and the chemicals that they use in the fracking process, but also the threat of development, roads, impervious surfaces that would cause siltation, would force New York City to filter its water, which is at least a $10 billion gamble.
But these are not uninhabited areas now, Ramsey Adams, right? I mean, there are already trucks that drive around there. It's not as though it's pristine at the moment.
No, but New York City has spent, millions and millions of dollars and lots of strategy to protect open space there. They've bought farms and easements, so the water supply has been very well protected in order to keep it from being filtered. So when you talk about, and one of your callers said that, drilling doesn't cause any kind of earthquakes, well, we've got underground tunnels that feed New York City. So the thought of drilling and shaking ground in and around the tunnels is just a scary thought. And I think that both of Ken and Amy have done a great job of just sort of laying out all of the questions that don't have answers. And we feel that the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation and the governor haven't done their job.
Amy Moll, weigh in here with the Natural Resources Defense Council. I mean, we count on you as maybe a kind of referee here. You know, we have our caller Kevin who says this is a bunch of poppycock. It's just fine, thank you. Ken who says, they should put all their cards on the table openly, but essentially conveying that it's safe. But you've told us about water contamination reports. Do you see, on the other hand, energy needs are serious and real as well? Is there is there a real threat that needs, you know, the brakes applied here or not, Amy?
Well, we think there is. And I think, you know, Kevin's description of the how a well is drilled with the cementing and the casing is helpful here. What's happened in places around the country is that sometimes that casing fails. The well basically breaches underground. And state agencies who are investigating have found this. What they haven't done is said, what was the link between that and the hydraulic fracturing? Did the hydraulic fracturing cause that well to fail? And that's really the question we need answered. But there are places, and Kevin mentioned Pennsylvania, there are places across Pennsylvania, a town called Dimmock, Pennsylvania, where 15 families have sued a company because their water is contaminated, and where people have gotten ill because their water is contaminated. Bradford Township, Pennsylvania, where at least 7 families have had their water wells contaminated. There's a lawsuit pending in western Pennsylvania, Washington County, where a farmer who has the largest heirloom tomato farm on the East Coast is suing. He had benzene, which is a known carcinogen, at 44 times the legal limit in his water, and it was tested before the drilling, so he knows that his water was clean beforehand. These are serious concerns. People are reporting illnesses in other places, in Wyoming, in Colorado, and in Pennsylvania and other states. And in addition, some places, livestock are ill. And again, I'm not saying these were specifically caused by a specific incident, because nobody's really investigated that to give people confidence that they can feel comfortable with these activities in their backyard. A really important other issue is some arcane legal construct called split estate. And it's really important when you're looking at oil and gas drilling, because what it means that is that even if you own the surface to your land, which is your yard and your home, you may not own the minerals underneath your land. When I say minerals, I mean oil and gas as well as other minerals. What that means in a lot of places is you cannot stop people from drilling on your own property. You cannot protect your own water. You cannot tell them where to drill or how to drill, because somebody else may own the oil and gas beneath your land, and they may have leased it out without even telling you. And that really adds a whole layer of complication here. These are industrial sites. They're right in people's backyards, or they're in wild areas that we care about and want to protect. And while there are industrial sites all over the country, usually they're in industrially zoned areas. And that's not the case here. And there are reports that, as you can imagine, if you were living in one of these places, you would really worry about, and you would want new regulations to protect you. And that's why we do think it's quite serious. And as I said, starting out, doesn't mean that we think natural gas production should not happen any place. But there are certain places where it should not happen, and every place else where it happens, we really need the strongest protections in place.
Ramsey Adams with the Catskill Mountain Keeper, do you see it happening in the New York City watershed? Is it sort of up on the rails already? You know, it's going to be or not?
Well, no, it's not going to happen in the New York City watershed. It can't happen in the watershed, and that sort of sets the bar. If it's not good enough for New York City, then is it good enough for the Southern Tier? Is it good enough for the Delaware? Think about the Delaware River, which is right in the heart of this. It feeds Trenton, Camden, and Philadelphia. That's where they get their water. So we're talking about 17 million people who get their drinking water from this part of the world, where they're talking about, you know, industrializing the region like it's never been done before.
Ramsey Adams, we've got to let you go. I know. I appreciate your joining us in Youngsville, New York, Executive Director of the Catskill Mountain Keeper. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about America's enormous natural gas reserve trapped in shale and the rewards and cost of getting it out. We've been joined by Amy Maul with the Natural Resources Defense Council. She's based out of Colorado, joining us today from Austin, Texas. And from Houston, Texas, Ken Medlock is here, a fellow in energy studies at Rice University. We've got a lot of callers here. Mary in Lawville, New York. Mary, you're on the air.
Thank you. Yes, I'm calling to represent the residents from Dimmock, Pennsylvania, having grown up near that area. The Cabot Oil and Gas from Houston is the one drilling there, and they have had a big change in the quality of their well water. And one day the resident's water well exploded, which made the state, when it investigated, it found that combustible gas had escaped into the region's groundwater supplies, and 13 wells were having been checked by the State Department of Environmental Protection, determined 13 wells were polluted, and three chemical spills had occurred in one single well.
What does it leave you thinking about shale gas, Mary?
Well, when I first heard about it, I thought it was great. I have a sister in Texas who has signed over for some gas under her land, and having this happen, this is it's pause for thinking and maybe rethinking how it's going to be gotten out of there, because if we have that gas there, which we do, it's needed, but it can't be at the expense of our people's quality of groundwater.
Need energy, but don't want exploding water wells. Mary, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Paul. Paul, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I'm a petroleum engineer. I've worked in the Barnett Shale for Mitchell Energy, one of the original pioneers in this.
In Texas, yes.
And I want to take issue. Hydraulic fracturing has been around for 50 years.
Though we're making advances in it, right? It's becoming more effective.
This isn't a new technology. Now, saying that, I do believe the callers are correct. I think what's happening on the fracturing is that you are running into some natural fracturing, which is mitigating the gas up into these usable water areas. Now, I don't know if you can do anything about that, but we have to make a decision nationally at what cost should we be sending our troops overseas versus drilling our minerals at home.
You make a good point, Paul. There's costs on many fronts. You've been engaged in this yourself. If it were happening, I don't know, under your home or your land or near your family's water supply, would you be comfortable with it, Paul, as a petroleum engineer?
It depends upon what area of the country I live in.
Why?
Well, I'm from West Texas. Mm-hmm. They've done hundreds of thousands of frac jobs there, haven't had any problems. But it sounds like they're having problems in Pennsylvania. So, you know, it just depends upon the rocks from where you live.
Paul, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much for calling in. Ken Medlock, how about it? You heard Amy Maul's sort of list of problem areas earlier. Here's Paul, you know, saying in West Texas he might be happy, but he's not sure in Pennsylvania. What should our national confidence level in this be? Or maybe it's got to be region by region. There are costs on every side when you look at energy, as Paul points out.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is a saying, you know, there is no free lunch. So if we're going to take a course of action, we have to be willing to recognize there may be costs associated with that course of action and be ready to deal with those costs in an effective manner. Now, he's absolutely right with regard to, you know, the heterogeneity of the geology around these shales. I mean, no shale is the same. I mean, you can apply a particular stimulation technique, say, in the Barnett Shale, but doesn't necessarily mean the same process. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about a breakthrough in technology, not the issue of hydraulic fracturing itself, but the way it's applied in these shales. It may not work, say, in the Fayetteville or the Haynesville or in areas of the Marcellus. And you really have to, I think, take a step back. And I find it interesting, actually, a lot of the issues that we're hearing about are in Pennsylvania, because, quite frankly, there's a lot of drilling, as the caller said, in West Texas. There's a lot of drilling, actually, around the Houston area, in an area called Katy, and there are massive suburban developments over the tops of all these things. And you can walk outside, and 100 feet away, there'll be a drilling rig. And there's never been an issue there. So it really is a matter of sort of locality of it. You sort of have to think about the geology in that particular region and what sorts of problems you might face. And so, you know, that is reason for pause, and it's reason for more careful study.
Let's take a call from Livingston, Tennessee, and Martha. Hi, Martha. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I think that part of this, I'm very concerned about, we have property in the Fayetteville Shale in Arkansas.
Yes.
That's actually where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
I'm driving right now. But my concern also is the way these gas companies walk over the common person. They have you sign contracts from the 1920s. They don't take care of the people. They don't respect the land.
It sounds like you're getting some feedback in your ear, but what we hear your concern, Martha, right there out of Fayetteville, Arkansas. And thank you for your call. Let me get one more right here from Detroit, Michigan. Bree, you're on the air.
Hi, everyone. Well, at the base of, you know, this, I applaud the scientific conversation And this may be the opinion of a naive liberal, but, you know, I think that we just need to move forward with clean energy, with renewable energy. This energy is going to be gone, and at the base of it all is greed by the oil companies and the people who, you know, make the money from the rights of the land that it's being drilled under.
What about, I mean, everybody would like to have absolutely clean energy, but if we don't have enough for our basic national needs, you know, right now, does this sound potentially better to you than a lot of coal-fired energy plants, which is possible, Bree?
Well, what bothers me is that, you know, we keep stalling. We keep stalling with the renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people out of work, especially in Detroit.
Yep.
And I think that we could, you know, create a lot of jobs with green energy. I think we just need to move forward with green energy and stop waffling.
I understand the question. Let me put it to my guest, Ken, first to you. Can we just skip this? Can we move right ahead to something that's not carbon-based, something cleaner?
Well, it would be nice, but I don't think it's realistic. As I said a minute ago, you know, there is no free lunch. If you tried to just sort of, stop all hydrocarbon-based fuels, that would come at a absolutely massive cost. And we talk about, you know, green jobs, but if you're going to actually talk about green jobs at the expense of other very commercial type activities that are in the hydrocarbon field, you're going to be sacrificing jobs there. So it's not a one for one deal. We have to be careful, and we have to really think carefully about what types of policies we engage. At the end of the day, we will be in a situation where it's all solar, all wind, you know, renewable, very clean sources of energy, because as has been pointed out on this call and has been pointed out in many other forums, we are talking about depletable resources at the end of the day. But we can use these resources to bridge from today to tomorrow, and that's really how we ought to think about this if we're going to be responsible.
Amy Mall at the NRDC, what do you think to of our caller Bree's concern out of Detroit? She'd rather skip it, rather get straight to the clean stuff and not do this at all. Do you agree with Ken that is it necessary? Is there a way around it?
Well, I mean, my house is heated by natural gas, and so I'm kind of hoping that production isn't shut down tomorrow, I have to say.
I'm not sure
that's what Bree was saying, but that's how some people interpret when people do talk about, you know, efficiency and renewables and transition, and that's not what we're saying. But efficiency, certainly, you know, the cheapest, fastest, easiest way to really transition to a clean energy future, that has to be our priority, and we have to devote as many resources to that, whether it's appliances or buildings or whatever, as we can. And certainly renewables, wind and solar and geothermal, these are things that really are, you know, where we're going to be in the future, and we have to transition to them. In the meantime, I think we do need natural gas, but, you know, we do think it's the transition, and we have to keep producing natural gas in order to supply our current usage, but we don't think it's the long-term solution to all our energy woes. It's not the answer because of the risks and because it's going to run out at some point anyway. But, you know, really, our public policies have to be focused on the clean solutions, energy and renewables. The private sector will continue to produce natural gas, but from a public policy perspective, we have to be focusing on the clean solutions.
But maybe also on keeping the carbon answers that are more immediate as clean as possible. A lot of it comes down to individual decisions, people deciding whether or not to sell, to have rights to this energy, gas, signed over to energy companies. Lisa Wanovich just joins us right now from Hancock, New York. She's up on that northeastern corner of the so-called Marcellus Shale, great big volume of shale that stretches from New York down through Pennsylvania into Ohio and West Virginia. She's a farmer there, organic farmer, been on the land there for 25 years with her husband, Mark. Lisa, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So a lot of your neighbors are thinking about whether or not to sell rights to this shale gas. You've been thinking the same. Let us into your contemplation. How are you looking at it?
Well, a lot of my neighbors and community members have signed. This has been an issue that has been in my mind for about 2 years, because the lands people, because they're not all men, have come into this area very aggressively and sold leases. It's something that, for me, seemed crazy from the very beginning, and I've learned a lot about it since then. I've been to many, many, many meetings, and
Are you selling rights, you and your husband Mark, or not?
No, never.
And because of safety concerns? Because you're, why?
Well, because of, although economically, you know, farmers need money. That sounds like, you know, money is always good. It's not worth the risk of the environment. It's particularly not worth the risk of the, polluting the water. It's not safe. This area is particularly susceptible. This is the foothills of the Catskills. It's full of water. It's the New York City watershed. It'll be devastating for the communities on every level, from a from the noise, from the pollution, from the roads, from the water that needs to be taken out of the wells, the ponds, the river.
Though you may be part of it, whether or not you sign on personally. I mean, you described your piece of land as in a sort of low-lying area, the farmer in the dell, I think you put
right.
it.
Right, yes. Yes, we're very concerned. Our neighbor above us signed for $25 an acre very recently. She didn't know any better. She also signed, as did many people in this area, the leases had, she signed away her water, meaning they could, in fact, take water from her pond or her well. That was, that was not in the lease. That was in the lease. So, it's potentially, you know, her water could be polluted, and if her water is polluted, it's going to roll right down to my pond and my fields.
Lisa Wonovich, right in the middle of it there in Hancock, New York, and you hear her concerns. On the other hand, the country needs energy, and there's the dilemma. Lisa, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Let me get a call from Dick in Ithaca, New York. Dick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I had two questions, if I can squeeze them in. One, I haven't heard addressed what the efficiency is of using these chemicals. Obviously, the oil companies are going to use whatever they can if it'll improve efficiency by 1%.
Of their yield of gas from down there, yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And a second question, if I can squeeze it in, the previous caller was addressing, the value paid per acre. What is it really worth to the oil companies? How high are they apt to go in what they pay? I've heard something like thousands of dollars.
But Lisa Wonovich mentioned $25 an acre, which seems like not a lot, but then I guess it depends what they think may be under there. Dick, let us try to get to that. Ken Medlock, first on the issue of the chemicals that go down, would it be possible to use a cleaner solution and maybe not get quite the efficiency of yield, but make it, but improve the safety assurance?
Well, I think at this point, yeah, I think the cleanest sort of hydrofracking would just be water and sand, and in fact, that's actually used, say, to stimulate water flow in well water that we drink in certain parts of the country. So, it is possible. There, I will just mention there's a lot of research going into the development of proppants that are not sand and not traditional ceramic, but actually use this is another field that nanotechnology is reaching into, and there's some actually very good work going on here at Rice with downhole technologies. But you basically use a nanotech infused ceramic proppant that allows you to get greater penetration when you do the frac job so that you actually stimulate more flow. Now, down the road, that could, in effect, be the replacement for the chemicals that we're talking about here. I don't know. But certainly anything that improves efficiency is going to come at a cost. I mean, everybody's going to extract as much rent as they can, so to speak. We'll have to see how it works out in terms of the economic efficiency of its use.
We've only got seconds for Dick's other question, but the value of these things, $25 an acre or thousands an acre, what's
that? That's a bit low. That's a bit low. But I will say this. A lot of what a company is willing to pay for with regard to, dollar per acre really depends on what they think is down there. I think you said it very well. If they think there's a very prolific play underneath their feet, they might be willing to pay much, much more than $25 an acre. If they don't, then the price that they're willing to pay will be driven down.
Amy Mall, last word goes to you. What is a safe development of this gas going to take? And do you see it coming, or are we still, out there with the Halliburton loophole and sort of drilling blind?
I I think there's a lot of momentum for changing the rules across the country at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level. The legislation to close the Halliburton loophole gains new co-sponsors every day. And I think, you know, what you're hearing from people in communities around the country is that they want change. This industry is being regulated, sometimes under regulations that are, you know, decades, 50 years old, and it's just not appropriate anymore. There are many new technologies. You know, I was appalled to hear that somebody leased their land for $25 an acre. Mm-hmm. I've heard that it costs up to $5 million just to drill a well in the Marcellus. And they're making tens of millions of dollars per well. And the fact is, we can all afford to do this in a clean and safe way where it's appropriate. And I think that's what people are waking up to around the country once they start experiencing this industry in their backyard, is that, yes, we need natural gas, but there's a way where we can do it in a safe way, we can have our energy, and we can do it in an affordable way, because the technologies, as Ken is saying, new technologies are being developed all the time. Let's put them in place.
And make them just as safe as they can with the energy future we're looking at. Amy Maul with the Natural Resources Defense Council, thank you so much for being with us, Amy.
Thank you very much for having this show.
And Ken Medlock at Rice, thanks for joining us, Ken.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.